sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list on The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Oh, hello there, and a good Sunday morning to you on this 15th day of October. Welcome into the Best of Downtown. Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell here with you. Best of Downtown brought to you, well, like the show is every weekday afternoon, by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program come your way in the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M open 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day of the week at the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. On the program this morning, some of our favorite conversations from the very recent past. We'll talk with USA Today soccer writer Martin Rogers, actor and author Bruce Campbell, Evil Dead, Burn Notice, and much more will visit with us and talk about his new book, Hail to the Chin. And our friend, author and critic Colin Fleming, chats up Bruce Pratt about the legendary jazz great Thelonious Monk on what would have been his 100th birthday. All that coming up this morning, Downtown brought to you by Quirk Auto Group, quirkauto.com. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. Well, one of the big sports stories this week involved the U.S. men's national soccer team. All they had to do was beat the worst team in their draw, Trinidad and Tobago, to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. They failed to do that with a 2-1 loss and find themselves out of the cup for the first time in forever. We talked about that with USA Today soccer writer and broadcaster Martin Rogers earlier this week. So, Martin, we'll cut to the chase. What happened to this U.S. team?
It was unbelievable. It was a remarkable campaign, Rich. It was one that had disappointment from start to finish. But the CONCACAF region that encompasses teams in North and Central America and the Caribbean is the most forgiving and easiest region to qualify from the World to the World Cup from. It allows 3.5 places to get to the tournament. The U.S. has qualified for the last 7 World Cups in a row. And even going into the last game, having won only 3 games out of 9 in the final round of qualifying, the U.S. was in a great position to make it to the World Cup. It only needed to tie against Trinidad and Tobago, the worst team in the group, which had only won 1 game out of 9, and it couldn't get the job done. A massive disappointment, and it'll be very interesting to see where U.S. soccer goes from here.
Now, as you wrote, this Trinidad and Tobago team was inspired by the attitude of the American team complaining during a practice session earlier in the week, and they didn't make any friends in this competition.
They didn't, and it just wasn't very smart. When you turn up to a small country, a country that has a proud soccer history, Trinidad and Tobago, but it's a small country of a couple of million people. They have nothing much to play for because they've already been eliminated from the tournament. The only way you can really bite yourself in the backside is by finding a way to piss them off. And that's exactly what the U.S. did. They turn up for training a day before the game, and there's water on the track that surrounds the field. Now, there's a couple of things you can do. You can decide to try and train elsewhere. You can just make the most of it and be like, okay, well, it's not ideal, but we'll just get on with it. Or you can act like a bunch of divas, and that's what the U.S. did. Bruce Arena was outraged by it. He spoke out about it. The U.S. started tweeting about it. The players were carried by team staff over this little bit of water instead of like splashing their way through it. I mean, for goodness sake, it was ludicrous. And this got up the nose of Trinidad and Tobago. The players were not happy about it. The coaching staff and the federation were not happy about it. And it inspired them. And they thought, you know what? We're going to show you guys a thing or two. You've come here, you've tried to embarrass us and make us look small time. All right, well, maybe we'll just mess up your dreams of getting to the World Cup. Exactly what they did. They were motivated. They played like the team that had everything to gain, and the U.S. had no answer for it.
And, Martin, you wrote about the fact that among the other problems with this team, there are some leadership questions, not only with Bruce Arena, but with Captain Michael Bradley. How deep do these leadership problems go with the American team?
I think the problems run from top to bottom throughout the federation, throughout American soccer, and it's problems that now, after this has happened, can no longer be ignored and swept under the carpet. Bruce Arena came in. He was seen as a very, very safe choice. Jurgen Klinsmann had been fired as head coach and was ousted after the first 2 defeats of the final qualifying round. And it looked like Arena was going to get the job done, but other teams very, very quickly worked out that the tactical system was not sophisticated enough to handle it if other teams just sat back and were content to soak up pressure. The U.S. just didn't have enough attacking force to break that kind of tactical opponent down. Michael Bradley is a good player, a fine professional. He takes his craft seriously. But last night you wanted to see the kind of rip-roaring passion from a leader that lifts people, that lifts the people around him, and it gets everyone realizing that everything is on the line here. And if they don't produce and if they don't leave everything on the field, then their dreams are going to get shattered. And that's what happened. And look, there's no lack of effort. It wasn't that the team didn't want it or that Michael Bradley didn't want it, but it just wasn't the right fit, wasn't the right mix of characters, wasn't the right approach. And it's a sad day. It's a sad day because American soccer has come so far. It's come an incredibly long way in actually a relatively short period of time. And this is a backward step. It's not going to crush soccer in this country. It's not that all these kids aren't suddenly going to stop playing. But that progress that was being made, it puts a brick wall in front of it. And it just slows down the whole process and pushes everything back 4 years.
We're talking with Martin Rogers here on Downtown. This is a team that has what many feel might be the best American player ever in Christian Pulisic. But as you say, it's a team that's also caught between generations. Can you explain?
It is, yeah. There's a lot of older players. Tim Howard has been an incredible servant for American soccer. He was brilliant at the last World Cup, and he's been a great goalkeeper for many, many World Cup cycles. Clint Dempsey, highest scoring American in national team history. Too old now. I'm sorry, just too old. And you've got to set out your store one way or another. I don't believe in this concept of sort of, like you said, trying to flip between the generations and then have sort of a mix of young and old. Like, if players are past it, unfortunately, they do have to go. And you have to go with the best of what you've got. And it's easy to say, oh, are these young players ready yet? Well, if they're the best players that you have at your disposal, you have no choice but to throw them in. But he really tried to nurse some of these young players through. Youngsters like Darlington Nagbe, DeAndre Yedlin, Kelly Acosta. They should have been at the front and center of this team rather than sort of trying to just sort of work their way in gradually. Throw them in. Let's see what these guys can do. If they can't do it, then find someone else. But it just hasn't worked. And it's incredible, really, that they came as close as they did. I mean, one more goal for them, the U.S. was in. If Panama hadn't scored in the 88th minute, the U.S. was in. But that doesn't change the fact that there were serious problems with this program for a significant amount of time, problems that needed to be fixed even if they had qualified for the World Cup and most certainly need to be fixed now.
So where does the U.S. team go from here, Martin?
Where do they go? It's a great question because this is a very strange confederation. In that, if you play in Europe, if you're a European team like England, France, Germany, and you suffer a catastrophic exit from a major tournament, it doesn't matter quite as much because the continental championships in Europe matter so much, and they matter so much in South America too. And so, if you miss out on the World Cup, you've got the Euros to look forward to 2 years from then. But it doesn't quite work like that in CONCACAF. The CONCACAF Gold Cup doesn't have anywhere near the same level of prestige as that. So if you're Christian Pulisic and you're looking at this, you're not going to have a chance to play in a major global event again for 5 years. He's 19 years old. He's coming towards his prime. There's a real risk that people like him start to drift away from the bond they have with the national team. Pulisic will still be playing for the U.S. in 4 or 5 years. But it erodes the bond a little bit. If you'd have put him in a World Cup at 19 years of age, he would have been forever emotionally tied to that national team. But think of the exciting things that are going to happen in his career over the next 5 years. He'll be playing in the Champions League, probably quarterfinals and semifinals, playing huge matches in the German Bundesliga and the German Cup and so on. And every time he comes back to the U.S. for a friendly against, a small Caribbean CONCACAF team or comes back for a Gold Cup game, it's just going to piss him off. It's a long travel, and it's not really going to feel like it's worth his time because it's not a huge, huge game. What does it do for the viewership and the audience? All these fans who have grown up for the past two or three generations, just assuming that the U.S. is going to qualify for the World Cup year after year, and it has. Now, there's a new set of youngsters. There'll be a bunch of 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds who this will be their first World Cup memory. And it'll be a memory that the U.S. was not in the tournament. They may find other national teams to love. There may be a lower standard of expectation on this national team when there should be a higher standard of expectation. It changes everything to a certain degree, and it's disappointing. It's not something that's irrevocably lost. Soccer is not going to suddenly go downwards and become the 10th most popular sport in America, but it's an opportunity lost. When you have momentum and you let it slip, that's tragic, because the US had momentum, and the league has never been as strong, MLS, as it is now. And the quality of players that they have to call upon have never been as good. And despite all that, they found a way to mess it up.
Yeah, and the only folks who might feel as bad or worse than the members of the team and their fans would be Fox Sports, having spent a ton of money on the World Cup.
Unbelievable, Rich. I mean, there's a possibility that this Fox Sports deal turns into the worst deal in the history of broadcasting. And it's not their fault. But let me talk to you about what happened with Fox Sports. So Fox Sports bought the right for the 2018 and the 2022 World Cup simultaneously. 2018 in Russia, 2022 in Qatar. They get completely screwed over 2022 because, as we know, Fox is a major player in NFL broadcasting. And because of the insane heat that is in Qatar in the middle of summer, when the World Cup always is, has been ever since 1930, they changed it. So the World Cup in Qatar that year is going to be held in wintertime, right smack bang in the middle of NFL season. Okay, so that completely ruined things for Fox. So as a result, FIFA said, okay, we will also give you the chance to buy, unopposed, the rights to the 2026 World Cup. And that was really to stave off potential legal action from Fox. So they have that. And now they have 2018 that doesn't have the US in it, which is going to be catastrophic for ratings. It's still going to be the biggest sports event of the summer. There's still going to be a ton of people tuning in, but it will be a drastically lower number than would have been tuning in if the US had played in it. And can you imagine if the US had gone on a run and reached the round of 16 or the quarterfinal? All those ratings lost, all that money from advertising and different things lost. So here's the thing. The only thing that can save this deal for Fox now is if the US gets the right to host the 2026 World Cup along with Canada and Mexico. It's the favorite right now. It's really the U.S., Canada, Mexico bid against a bid from Morocco, okay? And the U.S. seems by far to have the strongest bid, but you never know in FIFA. No one thought that Russia was going to get given 2018. Absolutely no one thought that Qatar was going to get given 2022. Both of those things happen. Now, if Fox doesn't have the shining light at the end of the tunnel of a home World Cup, which obviously would do monumental ratings. If it doesn't get that, like I said before, worst deal in the history of sports broadcasting.
Martin Rogers of USA Today weighing in on the U.S. men's national team's failure to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. It's the Best of Downtown here on a Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell with you. Hey, by the way, got a great show coming up tomorrow afternoon, including a Kerry conversation with the author of a very interesting book, a guy you had a chance to meet a few weeks ago, Damon Krukowski.
Yeah, the book's called The New Analog, and it's very interesting look at the switchover from analog to digital in recording technology, but also sort of some of the effects that it's had on people's relationships and interactions with each other and the environment and beyond just the changes in music.
Very interesting book. We think it'll be a fun conversation. That's coming up tomorrow afternoon. Plus, actress, author, podcast host Ileana Douglas, all this month featured on Monday night on Turner Classic Movies, their Trailblazing Women series, looking at some of the talented women behind the scenes in Hollywood for really the last 100 years or so. We've loved having her on the show in the past. She'll be with us tomorrow afternoon as well here on Downtown. When we come back, another Hollywood great, Bruce Campbell. Very interesting guy, much more than Ash, as we learn in his new book, Hail to the Chin, and in our conversation from this past week. It's up next on the Best of Downtown on the Pulse, WZON.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Getting properly spooky here for the month of October. It's the best of downtown. Sunday morning, Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell, and if you're a fan of Ash versus the Evil Dead, you know that is some of the music from the show. This past week, we had a chance to talk with the star of Ash versus Evil Dead and then so many other movies and TV shows. Bruce Campbell has got a brand new book, Hail to the Chin, and Carrie, one of the things we learned in that book was about his love of a particular television show.
Yeah, love he shared with my, grandmother born in 1889, so that was interesting to find out.
My grandparents as well, and well, that's how we began our conversation with Bruce Campbell this past week. You know our next guest on Downtown from Evil Dead, Army of Darkness, Burn Notice, Ash versus Evil Dead, Bubba Hotep, and so much more. He's also the author of a number of books, including Chin Happens, Make Love, The Bruce Campbell Way, and his newest, Hail to the Chin. But you probably didn't know, he's a closet Lawrence Welk fan. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
Man, I could listen to that Lawrence music all day long.
How did that happen?
You know, it's weird. My wife and I, we come from two different worlds. She had a much older father, and he would force her when she was young to sit on a couch Saturday nights and watch Lawrence Welk. And to her, it was like drilling, something into her eye. And so she couldn't get far enough away from it. Me, when I sit down I started watching it on PBS. They used to show it on Saturday nights as repeats, but they would show all the old shows. I started to tape them. I got like 35 of them on tape. To me, they entertain on so many levels, I can't even tell you. It's the greatest. They capture the time frame in the clothing, 70s, 80s. They got the long sideburns. They got the lapels that are 5 inches wide. It's just awesome. It's spectacular what it is. You can't take your eyes off it.
Oh, you're absolutely. And I bet somewhere, even though they're not together anymore, I bet Guy and Rolna still look good.
I think Guy was a bad boy, by the way.
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Bobby and Sissy.
Oh, yeah. Now, I don't know if you know this, Bruce. The owner of our station is author Stephen King. Can you talk about what he did for you in helping make Evil Dead such a big hit?
You know what? He actually helped us twice, and I just had to remind myself recently – the first movie, Stephen King saw Evil Dead over at the Cannes Film Festival. It was at a screening there because we were there doing foreign sales. It wasn't about the film festival. So he comes in, sees it, writes an article about it in Twilight Zone magazine, called it the most ferociously original horror film of the year, among other things. And we did a double take. We're like, wait, what did he just say? Because, you know, we had gotten other reviews, and they certainly weren't that good. And so we went to him of like, hey, Mr. King, could we use that quote? And he goes, yeah, as long as you put a year on it, you know. So now we have to say of 1983, which is fine. But immediately after that quote that we put on our poster, it sent a force field of protection around the movie. Next thing you know, a couple of weeks later, Kevin Thomas at the LA Times called it an instant classic. So I'm like, okay, good. Thank you, Mr. King. And then we go to make this. Our second film we make is called Crime Wave. It bombs horribly. So we go, okay, all right, time to start thinking about Evil Dead 2. Otherwise, our careers are doomed in this business. So we keep trying to make it over and over again. It's not working. We have a crew member that we had hired briefly to help with some scheduling and stuff. And she goes, okay, well, if you guys have to let me go. We're like, yeah, we can't find the money right now. We'll give you a holler later. She goes down to North Carolina, where Dino De Laurentiis had moved his operations. She starts prepping on a movie directed by Stephen King, which I think was Maximum Overdrive. They're shooting the bull on set. Stephen King's like, hey, what have you been working on? Oh, I've been these guys trying to make Evil Dead 2. Stephen King goes, oh, I'll just talk to Dino De Laurentiis. He talks to Dino. He goes, Dino, you know, you should make this movie. I swear to God, we had a deal in about 15 minutes.
Wow.
So we are actually vastly indebted to Mr. King on all fronts.
And, of course, helped by another friend of our show, John Hodgman, who helped get you your first book deal and then wrote the introduction to the new book.
Exactly. It seemed only fitting at the time to call him up because he's become quite the raconteur. He's got a new book coming out himself.
Absolutely.
Proud of that young man.
He's done well for himself, no doubt about it. So another book for you about, 15 years after the first one. What do you get from having this different creative outlet to go along with the acting?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's not as many chefs when you write a book. You write a book, you sit down, it's you and Mr. Computer staring at each other in the face, and you bang it out. And I have a very good editor that I work with, but these guys don't jump all over you. You know, they let you do your thing. I have a great graphics guy that I work with. You know, creatively, it's about 98% mine, as opposed to a movie. Oh, my goodness. They have to do previews with unemployed people to see what they think of the movie. And if they don't like something, they go back and reshoot. I mean, so the filmmaker doesn't really have a lot of say, especially the bigger the budget. So this is a great creative outlet because it actually feels creative.
Bruce, and you just touched on it a little bit, but you've done a lot of producing over the years along with the acting and stuff. Is that something that was an ambition for you right in the beginning, or more of a function to get the films that you want to be involved with made?
It was a protection that just turned out to be a good idea. You know, no one was making movies where we lived in suburban Detroit. And no one was going to cast me in a movie, especially with no experience. So because we raised ourselves the money ourselves, I just gave myself the part, essentially. So I seriously say, whenever an actor goes, do you have any advice how to become an actor? I'm like, yeah, become a producer. And and they look at me weird, but it's so true. But get your hands on some material. You're a producer. Option some guy's story. You know, you want a good part? Write it, you know, write it yourself. You may have to start out as a bit of a one-man band. I'm still a one-man band.
We're talking with Bruce Campbell here on Downtown. The book is called Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, and a B-Movie actor who spent a lot of time in the last couple of decades working in television and very successfully. Burn Notice, it was such a fun series for so long, other than, as you write about in the book, other than dealing with the Miami climate, it seems like that was just a great experience.
You know, it was. It's nice to be on a show that it's actually a hit. You know, I've been part of stuff that's like been marginally successful or okay successful. That thing was just, it took off right from the start. And, you know, I don't know, I think we were probably 2-3 years or so on top of the cable, on top of the heap there for a little bit. And it felt great because it meant everyone was in a good mood as a network. And when they're happy, we're happy. And when we're happy, everyone's happy. So it was nice. It's a very challenging show. Episodic television is a bruiser. But we did 111 episodes, which is, we tied Miami Vice exactly to the number.
You also made a memorable appearance as President Ronald Reagan in Fargo. What was that experience like playing not only a legend, but someone that everybody has a pretty good idea what they look like, what they sound like, how they move?
Well, daunting is the word. That's a good word. I sent a test tape to my buddy John Cameron, who's producing it. John and I go back to high school together. John wound up working with the Coen brothers on their earlier movies and worked his way up, and now he's, you know, he produces with them. And so John and I, you know, through the 80s at the Ronald Reagan decade, Ronald was on television all the time. We couldn't get him off the TV, and he and I, we'd imitate him mercilessly. Who wouldn't? He's a guy who's fun to imitate. And so I think when this came up, John went, oh, I know who could do that. Campbell can do that. But the trick was to now tone it down, make it a character, you know, not an impression. And I was worried because, you know, this show won an Emmy. I taped myself doing it. I said, look, guys, if you want to fire me, this is how I was thinking of doing it. So if you want to fire me, now's the time. So, but they said, no, it's fine. So it worked out fine. It was very fun to do. And look, it's also nice to be on classy shows. I'm on shows that are fun, like Hercules and Xena, but not always the classy ones. Like even Burn Notice is really just like, it's like B television.
Well, when
it's still pretty girls and crap is always blowing up and people shooting at each other.
When you talk about iconic characters, they don't come much bigger than the King. Playing Elvis and Bubba Hotep, and then getting to work with a legend like Ossie Davis, it had to be daunting as well. But I have to tell you, of all your performances, that's top three all time for me. Love the movie and love your work as Elvis in that.
Well, it's funny. It was one of the weirdest scripts I've ever read. Don Coscarelli sent it to me, and you got to get past the first few pages because it starts out pretty startling with what's happening. But then once you get past it, I felt that the guts of it were actually kind of nice. It's these two guys forming a relationship who are forgotten. I thought it had a nice theme. Oh, yeah, and there's a mummy. You know, it was I thought it was an interesting flavor to it. I thought Joe Lansdale, you know, he's a great writer. And Don Coscarelli, I knew from Phantasm because he did his first movie right around the time we did the first Evil Dead. So
right.
We were very much compadres in the same trenches, you know. So that was definitely that was saying yes. But now to get Ozzy, I don't know how the hell Don got Ozzy. You know, first day I met him, I'm like, Ozzy, I know why I'm in this movie. I don't know why you're in this movie. He said his grandkids knew who I was and they liked Evil Dead. So thanks for that.
Yeah, that's a good enough reason. Speaking of Evil Dead, Ash versus Evil Dead, that's another big hit for you. Was it February 25th, season 3 comes out?
Yeah, it's coming like a freight train. They delayed it. They moved it. They're shuffling a couple of their shows at Starz. And they, you know, guys do this all the time. Networks, it's their favorite thing is to move shows. So I'm fine with that because there, you know, might be a quieter time period where people are frozen in snowdrifts and have nothing else to do but watch television.
That's a great show. I watched a lot of the season one this weekend, went back and rewatched it. What's the experience been sort of rejoining some of the people that you worked with in on previous series?
Working with the old schmoes is great. That's always fun. But it's sort of like working with your brothers. You're always sort of snipping at each other because you know each other too well. But it's actually been great. But actually pulling it off, that's where we go, oh my God, they said yes, we have to do this show now. And to sustain television is it really is a, I always crawl away from every season sort of throwing up a little bit of blood. It's a soul killer, these things. But season three is going to be a game changer. I'm telling you right now.
Well, we look forward to that. It's got to be cool, too, after these many years in the business, to think about you and Sam Raimi growing up in Michigan and having these dreams about doing this thing and now seeing the way it's played out and the success that you've both had.
Yeah, it's been kind of, to me, it's been hilarious to watch Sam become a big Hollywood director. It just, it cracks me up. Because, you know, I did a small part in Oz the Great and Powerful. I played a Winky for like one day. And so where he's directing me, and he does his usual, he's always full of funny insults and stuff like that. And so I started insulting him back. And the crew, I swear to God, there was a hush you could hear. They were like, did that day player just talk back to Sam like that? And I went, oh, my God, everyone's kissing your ass, Sam. How's that feel?
And you gave Tobey Maguire a hard time, too.
Oh, always. Well, no, he kept, the first time he's like, oh, yeah, you're Sam's pal. Second movie, I come back in. He gives me this look of like, why are you back? Then the third movie, he goes, oh, I get it. I guess we just can't make a Spider-Man movie without Bruce Campbell. I'm like, that's right, pal. You're starting to get it.
Now, you make the point in the book about the first Spider-Man film really being a B movie made and promoted with an A budget, and that it sort of opened the floodgates of that trend. Do you see that spreading more beyond? Do you see that spreading more beyond sort of the superhero genre into the more traditional science fiction fantasy stuff?
We'll always have, look, we got Blade Runner, you know, even though it's bombing, but we'll always have sci-fi is one of the great genres, and we'll always have them. There will always be horror movies, and frankly, because of things like It and Walking Dead, horror has become much more mainstream than when we first started. And horror will always be around. Westerns will come and go. You know, that used to be a very reliable genre. Comedies will always be around. Big budget action movies will always be around. People love stuff to blow up. But the superhero guys got to be a little careful. I'm not sure that that's going to become a permanent genre, like that will be an evergreen genre. These things are expensive, and if a couple, two or three of them bomb, I'll tell you what, the guys in tights are going to go bye-bye.
Now, they're not all massive hits. Is the story you relate in the book true? Do you really use VCR copies of Man with the Screaming Brain as insulation?
That's perhaps a bit of an exaggeration, but it actually did sync up. It coincided with basically the death of VHS was Man with a Screaming Brain. Put the final nail in the coffin. They're like, screw this format and screw this movie.
Now, you mentioned in the book, and we were talking about it before we called you up, you've talked about being a game show host, and you've done that a little bit, and you had an idea, and we thought it was a brilliant idea for a late night kind of show.
Well, we ran one season on a sort of a live streaming site, and then we didn't come back for a season two. We had other fish to fry. We thought, let's go back and do it live. I'm going to 35 cities, so we pitched it to the bookstores. They're like, hey, you want to do a little something extra? We can do this. And about half of them said yes, so it's been really fun to go to these venues. And one day before this tragedy in Vegas unfolded, we were on the strip at the Hard Rock doing the show.
Well, if you ever make your way to the East Coast, we'd love to have you come up here and pay a visit. We'll see if we can get Stephen King out of the house to come say hello as well.
I'll be honest with you, I'm trying to book more Hard Rocks because I want to get into the casino circuit, because this show is perfect for Vegas.
Mm.
It can be a completely over-the-top, you know, glitzy, fun, fast-paced show, and it's very interactive. Everybody comes in, gets a clicker. Everyone is playing. Everyone is competing against each other right from the beginning. And we don't vet anybody, so it's any schmo who can get the right answers can come up there. So it's just been a lot of fun. We're going to continue to do it. We're going to Korea, we think, in January to do it for the troops.
Oh, that sounds great. Now, Bruce, let me ask you a question. I'm pretty sure I've never asked anybody on the show. Certainly, I've never asked a man. How's your lavender?
quite nice. Thank you very much. It's an older field, but it's still producing because we had a wicked winter meaning really good, great snowpack, tons of water, and then a hot summer, and that's what lavender wants. So my wife and I harvested it with a bunch of friends. We always do that. We throw it in the back of a pickup, well, not a U-Haul, take it north to Eugene, Oregon, and distill it with the same family we've distilled with for, 15 years now. And we got about, 18 pounds of essential oil. And look, there's no value to this. This is not a money-making operation. We use this stuff for like, hi, Merry Christmas, here's your stuff.
We could use a sachet here. You know what radio guys smell like.
Oh, boy, let me tell you.
Bruce, thank you so much. Absolutely love the book. It's a great read. We look forward to season 3 of the show as well. We appreciate you making time for us. Good luck on the book tour.
Thank you, guys. See you around. See you for the sequel, I guess you'd say.
That's Bruce Campbell here on the Best of Downtown. Fun stuff on your Sunday morning. When we come back, we're going to get all jazzy on you here. Thelonious Monk would have turned 100 years old this week. Our friend Colin Fleming talks about him, his music, up next on the Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Whatever you're looking for, G&M Family Market has got what you need. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. They have fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, a Dunkin' Donuts right there, and an Amato's as well. And if there's something you can't find, just ask, and they'll make every effort to get it for you next time. It's G&M Family Market, Route 1A, Route 46 in Holden. They're open every day from 6 in the morning until 9 p.m.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
One of the real originals in the history of jazz as both a performer and a composer, Thelonious Monk, who would have turned 100 years old this week, and on the occasion of his 100th birthday, our friend, author, and critic Colin Fleming talked with Bruce Pratt about Thelonious Monk here on the Best of Downtown.
Colin, welcome back to Downtown.
Hey, how's it going, Bruce?
It's going well, sir. I was really excited when Rich told me that I would get a chance to talk to you about this. Big Monk fan. Introduced to me by Chris Brubeck, Dave Brubeck's son, who I went to junior high school with, who said to me, I know you like my dad's piano playing, but you got to check out this guy. He does some neat stuff.
I can understand sort of the parallel there, because you have two very melodic Janis, right? We think of Brubeck as maybe more mainstream, but he also has weird time signatures, just like Monk. So we don't tend to think there's much overlap between the two of them, but I can see a comparison there.
Yeah, and a lot of, what Chris pointed out to me was a lot of improvising over those really neat, syncopated, funny, differently structured chords because Monk had such huge hands.
I think Monk actually got a lot of his early style from Count Basie. We don't usually think of Count Basie as like this extraordinary pianist. We think of him as an amazing band leader. But that was kind of the swing that I feel that Monk had. He listened to Art Tatum a lot, and you would never associate Monk with Tatum because Monk was kind of a chord man, whereas Tatum was all sorts of crazy runs and glissandos and finger-breaking virtuosity. But I think from out of that swing tradition and then coupled with bebop and slowing bebop down, it allowed Monk to work spaces inside of his music, to write from within spaces, almost like Ahmad Jamal later would, in ways that other composers didn't even think.
Well, one of the things you also pointed out in some of the things I've read that you've written is that Monk may be sort of overlooked sometimes because he wasn't a prolific songwriter. I mean, he's credited with some 70 or 80 songs. I don't remember exactly what the number is. But when you think about his innovation and his style and his incredibly complex compositions, which people often thought were improvising, maybe he really deserves to be right up there at number one.
I think so. You'd be hard-pressed to dislodge Duke Ellington. Ellington was every bit the innovator while having however many songs Duke Ellington had, right? I don't know if you could be much more prolific. So Monk was kind of like a Vermeer, right? He had that 70-odd song. And what's strange, too, about his songs is they're strange.
Yes.
And yet they're standards. They're almost like Gershwinian, right? Because they kind of shouldn't be standards. They're so atypical. And a standard usually is not quarterly atypical like Monk's were. And they're so complicated, too, harmonically, that if you listen to, like, Blue Monk, it is as tuneful as All You Need Is Love, as a Schubert later. It's, like, as tuneful as you can get. So, yes, he's packing a lot in harmonically, rhythmically, in terms of dissonance, but you can walk down the street literally whistling his composition, which is a neat little trick to pull off.
Well, yeah, and the other thing I think is interesting is his relationship with so many of the great sax players.
And
he's Bud Powell and John Coltrane and Bird and all these other guys. Do you think there was something that he heard in the sax that he brought to the piano?
Yes, and I think vice versa. Those tenor players heard something in the way he approached the piano. He must have been like manna for a man like John Coltrane. He's playing in Miles Davis's first grade quintet, and you just talk about like a band that could blow any other off the stage. I mean, that's one of the great small units in all of jazz history. But Coltrane starts to get bored. It's sort of like a glorified, highly impressive, but still at its root version of hard bop.
One of the songs you talk about is Monk's Mood. Carrie, can you punch up just a little bit of that so we can let the listeners get a feel for this? And as you point out, Colin, Monk is best heard live. His live recordings are the tops. Even in that short snippet, as you mentioned, you can hear what a chord guy he was. A lot of chords underneath that melody.
It's very ambulatory, too. It sounds like the composer/player is walking along with you through this piece of music, maybe taking a sidestep here, a step back here, and then ultimately moving forward again. And I think it was that knack for creating that kind of space within sound that someone like Coltrane really needed to hear. And they were phenomenal together. And Coltrane and Monk recorded at Carnegie Hall in 1957. And I think by any metric, that's one of your five or six best live jazz recordings ever. And Monk made a lot of live recordings after that going forward.
Am I wrong to just think, I mean, I'm not an expert on this by any stretch, but it seems to me that he made more live recordings than most piano players of his generation. Do you think that was because he was so enamored with live playing?
I think it was a combination of things, really. He was what was called at the time quite eccentric.
Yeah.
And now we have evidence that maybe there were some other things going on with him mentally. And I don't know that he was able to sort of work through the rigors of composition after a certain point. But I also think that's a little bit misleading, because in concert, Monk was constantly writing and rewriting those pieces and rejiggering them. And he was someone who wrote, I think, more than even most jazz musicians through listening. I think that was another thing he helped Coltrane with. But it was kind of that external stimuli gave him internal revelations on how to approach his own material. So it's not shopworn. When you hear him taking a different version of one of his songs, it's like an entirely new composition, and maybe he just hangs it on those old chords. So even that was pretty innovative. But yeah, it's a lot of live albums. Now, if you go through anyone's discography from that era, jazz is wonderful because we can get the entire week-long residency of somebody, and we don't get that with like rock and roll.
You right.
might get like Live at Leeds by The Who. You get one night. And I think Monk's live output stands out so much because he was so infrequently in the studio for a long time.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown, and we're talking about what would have been the 100th birthday of the great jazz pioneer Thelonious Monk, often associated as being a bebop guy, but I've always thought he sort of transcended all kinds of bop. Am I wrong about that? Or
no, I think you're quite correct. And it's weird because he was sort of the first jazz musician I got into when I was in my mid-teens, and I had first heard Charlie Parker, and Parker was going so fast.
Mm.
That was bebop. It was like he was almost lapping himself, and I wasn't quite ready to hear that. So when I'm reading about Monk and he's so tuneful and it's slowed down, I'm thinking, wait, this is bebop too? This doesn't sound like what Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie are doing. But it was like he took those same rhythmic contours and he just disseminated them differently. He deployed them differently. Everything slowed down, and yet you never felt like you were going too slowly. And he became the sole occupant of this Monkian universe, really, which he brought other people into. But I think it's almost like Sun Ra. Like, how do you categorize him? It's sort of sci-fi, it's bluesy, it's its own sort of private orbit. And Monk was the same way. He completely transcends labels, and yet he influences so many different genres simultaneously.
I know the late Dave Van Ronk, who was a friend of mine, said to me, you know, it was when he heard Charlie Parker, the same reaction you did. There was so much going on, he wasn't sure what was happening. He sort of liked Ben Webster better. He says, then I started listening to Monk and realizing you can have a lot of things happening as long as you leave some spaces for people to think. And that's what I always felt about Monk's music.
And Monk, he played at Minton's, like in 1941, After Hours joint, where Charlie Christian is playing his pivotal role in inventing bebop. And I think Charlie Christian was a pretty Monkian guy himself. He was fast, but he wasn't like Charlie Parker fast on the guitar. And that sort of dovetails nicely with what Monk was doing. So you have this smoky room, if you can imagine that, and all of these people cross-pollinating these different attributes and styles. And Monk remained his own man, which I find like fascinating, because everyone got caught up in the speed game and Monk didn't. And I think some of that speaks to what an individual he was. And maybe he only had it within him to write the 70 songs, because let's put it this way. You can have 70 songs and they can really be like 70,000 songs. There's all different kinds of ways to quantify these sorts of numbers. It's like a book. I mean, Great Gatsby is 47,000 words long, but it might as well be 800,000 words long for everything it imparts. And when I hear Monk, I'm still constantly unpacking things that he was doing in 3 minutes and 23 seconds. And it never feels like 3 minutes and 23 seconds.
Well, yeah, that was the other thing. I was just getting ready to ask you that question. A lot of his songs, when they're recorded, they're not 7, 8, 9 minutes long. They're not. There's not a whole lot of extra soloing and riffing and all that. He keeps the melody intact throughout. And it seemed that he did, when he recorded, do you think he consciously had his sidemen or the other players with him conscious of that all the time? Don't forget the song. Don't forget the melody.
I think so. It's like Edgar Allan Poe said that, hey, if you can't experience it in one sitting, it's really not worth doing.
Yeah.
Now, that's a little fatuous, but that's, I guess, what you would say if everything you wrote was a short story. But I think Monk, they're almost like these preternatural singles, really. They're like 45s, more so than like long-playing sort of epic tracks. And I would bet his bandmates were well spent trying to keep up with this guy, trying to work through the changes. When he did that, there was the recording ban during World War II, and then like bebop was unleashed after it. And yet Monk really didn't kind of start doing his thing until 1947. And that was his kind of big breakthrough session. Breakthrough, not commercially, but I think artistically. But like swing and blues, jump jive was going at the time. And I think that permeated his thinking, too, that, like, this isn't just supposed to be these long cuts. I don't want to say jukebox-friendly, but he always was kind of, like, amenable to that sort of notion.
Well, I think that it's great that someone is keeping him in the forefront of people's minds. I saw that documentary a few years back where his son played a role, and I think Monk is just such a fascinating American character. You know, I mean, he really seems to me to be, I don't know how to say, as American can be. He's an original. He only could have come from where he came from. And that whole New York sensibility of I'm just going to go out and play what I want to play and do what I want to do and sort of survive, not in an arrogant way, but in a very creative way.
I don't think it hurt him that he had his cabaret card revoked.
Yeah.
It basically meant that he couldn't perform live for quite a time in New York City. You think, like, what could be worse for a jazz musician back then, right?
Because right.
Unlike now, this was your full-time gig, or it could be. This could be your day job, so to speak, even though you're playing at night. And I think it kind of made him write the way he did, concentrate on writing. A lot of times, composers in jazz, they rewrite the same song. They just give it a different name. They put in some different solos. They have a few different chord changes. Monk didn't really do that. So that's another way of looking at his 70-plus songs. They are awfully disparate, one from the other. And I think part of that was because he had to write. He couldn't gig. He could gig out of town, but what happens when you gig out of town? You're on the road. What else are you going to do? You're going to write.
Colin Fleming on Thelonious Monk as we wrap up the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball and Kerry Haskell getting set to wrap it up. Hope the rest of your weekend goes well. Are the Red Sox playing this? Oh, no. No, it's not.
No, they are.
It's all over. All
it done. Is. Not the crying.
Exactly. We'll talk about whatever is going on in sports tomorrow afternoon. Major League Baseball playoffs. Maine football coach Joe Harris-Simiak going to join us tomorrow. Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald on the Black Bears and the New England Patriots, who take on the first-place New York Jets today. That should be an interesting game. Plus, coming up tomorrow afternoon, as we mentioned, author Damon Krukowski and his new book, The New Analog, and a lengthy conversation with Ileana Douglas. You know her from so many great films like Cape Fear, A Grace of My Heart, Goodfellas. She is the author of a wonderful book on her love of the movie business and the industry called I Blame Dennis Hopper, which is also the name of a wonderful podcast that she does. All this month, she hosts on Monday nights Trailblazing Women, that series on Turner Classic Movies. And we'll talk with her about that, the role of women in film, and much more tomorrow afternoon. So we hope you'll be around for that. I want to remind you, too, while we have a chance, 1 month from today, our big event coming up over in Brewer at the Performing Arts Center with actor, author, and storyteller Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I still got a couple of the podcasts of his to finish up, so I can tell him that I've listened to the whole series. But I'm really looking forward to that evening. It should be a great a great performance.
Yeah, it's going to be November 15th, 7:30 p.m., Brewer Performing Arts Center on Pendleton Street. Stephen will be telling stories about his career, reading from his latest book, My Adventures with God. Here's how you get in. You go to the Briar Patch, Central Street in downtown Bangor, or come right here. Our studio's on Broadway, and you can buy your ticket for $30. Not only does that $30 ticket price get you in the door, but it gives you a copy of Stephen's book, My Adventures with God, which in and of itself is about a $25 value. So it's going to be a great night. Stephen is going to stay around, I'm sure, and sign books as well. It'll be a lot of fun. You know him, of course, as Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day, but so much more. Californication, Deadwood, Memento, One Day at a Time, The Goldbergs, Silicon Valley, the list goes on and on and on. You'll want to make sure you're there to see Stephen Tobolowsky Wednesday, November 15th in Brewer. All proceeds benefit Congregation Bethel. Get your tickets right now at the Briar Patch in downtown Bangor. Hey, thanks for being with us today. Don't forget the Pulse Morning Show with Don and Paul tomorrow at 6. Our plans are to be here at 4 o'clock. Hope you'll do the same for the next edition of Downtown. Stick around. Casey Kasem, American Top 40, the 80s, up next on the Pulse, AM 620 WZON. You're gonna be